We've done this the last couple of years, and especially last year, we turned it into a luncheon. And essentially, this is the industry update that talks about the standards. MESA isn't necessarily a standards-driven body. We do some standards on the security side, but that's it. The rest of it is best practices, thought leadership, and trying to move the needle. But we absolutely rely on other organizations to create, develop, drive, and implement standards so that this ecosystem, as we call it, comes to fruition. And it's an absolutely essential piece of this business. So each of these associations will step up and give you 10 minutes and talk about who they are and what they do and give you an update as to the latest that they are doing and driving. And I've also brought a gentleman to kind of kick it off. Philip Hodgetts is going to come up, and he's a metadata guru. You go to metadata.guru or metadata.guru.com. But bottom line is Phil is also quasi-technical metadata, quasi, and also bridges the gap over into SMPTE on the engineering side. So Phil's going to kick it off. Everyone has 10 minutes. Keep crunching, munching, and enjoying, but I think you're also going to learn something, and it's a good broad swath to say, all right, where are we really at? So with that, let's welcome Philip up to begin.
Thank you. I am a metadata geek, I self-confess, but I come from the production side. So while I have never metadata I didn't like, my focus is more on metadata for the purpose of production. And of course, you know, we have heard already about the importance of metadata for the future. Without metadata, without this love note to the future, we seem to be moving forward automatically.
You've got 10 minutes.
So yeah. Okay. Thanks. I'm going to repeat it. Okay. Lumberjack was brought up earlier. We need to bring the acquisition of metadata earlier in the process, and that's what Lumberjack system is. We do have people on the set logging. They're called Lumberjackers because Lumberjack, of course, is a logger. So the uniform for an on-set logger will, of course, be Lumberjack plaid. And the future without love, without a love note to the future, a love note to ourselves, without being able to get the material that we've logged and everything, is a future that we don't want to face. What we have got is a time when metadata is considered to be important. When I that's continuing automatically. Okay. I will try and work around it. My focus is really on metadata for production, and I'll come back to that a little bit. We are in an era where people appreciate metadata in a way that they didn't 5 or 10 years ago. People are attempting to get budgets for metadata acquisition. People are applying machine learning to improving the metadata. People are using freeform databases to extract metadata from freeform text. These are all good developments, and we're really, really pleased that we are actually going to have them. Next slide? Yep. I'm good again. Okay. And that's, you know, we can have the conversation about metadata that we could never have 10 years ago. I'm glad to be in an environment where I can talk about it without having to self-censor like at Thanksgiving or at home with my family in Australia, who have no idea what I'm talking about when I talk about metadata. In fact, one of the interesting things is I came to a lot of the metadata madness sessions thinking that, wow, time to get with some of the other metadata geeks and really sort of appreciate what metadata can do for us. And then I realized that nobody was talking the same language. It was great. It was talking about metadata, but it was focused on this distribution side. It focused on discovery and recommendation. And this is all good because if we don't get that sale, if we don't get the product out to our customers, we don't have income. We don't get to make any more of this stuff. So it's great work being done with the standards bodies. We love unique identifiers in the database world, in metadata world. And these organizations you're going to hear from are all doing great things to make this metadata flow a little bit more smoothly. But my focus is And of course, there's a lot of technical metadata that has to be used in these distribution channels. There's also content metadata, metadata about the content of the images and the content of the programs. And at this point, we're talking about finished programs. And that's, you know, absolutely the right way to go. And the more we can do of that, the better. Today's buzzword is, of course, going to be machine learning. It's what most people mean when they say artificial intelligence. It's certainly every time you see something in the media about artificial intelligence, they're almost certainly talking about machine learning. We will hear about more applications of machine learning into the recommendation and discovery space and in the acquisition of metadata out of existing programs and archives. But there's a subset of machine learning that we can pull onto at any time, and these are the basic cognitive services, where machine learning has been used to solve common tasks. These don't require any complex programming, any data sets or anything. These are off-the-shelf APIs that we can pull on at any time and integrate into our workflows. Metadata about productions is awesome. But I think we're missing a big opportunity, and that is that the metadata story in production sucks. I think pretty much is the way the best description right now. There are still way too many productions that rely on the Bible, the book of every piece of information, that the shot notes from the set are not making it through to editorial, that people aren't using the opportunity to acquire metadata and use it beyond just acquiring metadata from source time code and tracking all the time codes, that sort of metadata. But we also need to start thinking about applying metadata to help us with the productions, particularly with non-scripted production. We have interviews, we have footage that is very free form. It's very hard to deal with. And frankly, we've gone back to the old presentation. We skipped a couple of slides. That's okay. I had the wrong one. Okay. Effectively, nothing has changed in production and the way we use metadata in production since the advent of Media Composer version 1. Yes, it's gone from 320 by 240 in 4 bits, 16 grayscale, up to 4K in full color, but we're still fundamentally making productions the same way that we did 15 and 20 and 25 years ago when we first introduced electronic editing. Now we have a whole lot of services that we can use to start to automate the production of metadata, acquisition of metadata, but also to automate the production itself. This is a challenge that I have been trying to solve since we got into the software business nearly 10 years ago. Very first product out of the gate was an automated editing system based on metadata, and I'll talk a little bit more about that, but this has been an ongoing quest. It failed because of the lack of metadata. It's no good if you can use the metadata if you don't actually get the metadata in the first place, and that's where that particular system fell down. Now we don't have to wait for somebody to transcribe an interview. We don't have to wait for somebody to pull out keywords and concepts. Keywords and concepts are all great organizational tools, but they're also great long-term value so that you know where in your entire archive library is something about automobiles or about drag racing or about these concepts. These ability to have all this information available to us is so useful. Knowing the content of every image off the set, all of your B-roll identified and used, sentiment analysis and emotion analysis, just being able to determine in reality TV where are the high emotion points in the footage is going to give you a head start on editorial. You probably have heard of the Morgan trailer, which was edited by an AI. No such thing. A machine learning tool was programmed to pick out emotion, and it did pick selects based on emotion and action, the same sort of things that a trailer cutter would use. All this data produces raw information that we need to be able to bring into our concepts that match and keywords that match the production, not the generic answers that we're getting back from these tools. They're also the way that we can deal with merging data silos as the need arises. So back to the problem that I'm trying to solve. is we created an application called First Cuts. First Cuts would produce a first cut. Actually, there was some dispute over that term. I would now refer it to as a first string out, because some people use the term first cut as the first cut they submit to a network, and we're not talking about that. We're talking about a way of exploring the material. It's interesting when technology becomes abundant, that and you have spare cycles, that you have the way then to experiment. We have wonderful graphics because we have spare cycles. When you have the right metadata, you can explore the story by combining keywords and string into string outs in many different ways. And we did B-roll, we created story arcs, we put lower thirds in to identify people. It was a reasonably good, competent story, but it wasn't emotionally compelling. That's the job of the editor. Getting to that starting point where we could have something that an editor could really start to polish, that's really efficient. One example that was generated in 30 seconds was about a 13-minute piece, which in 40 minutes I cut down from absolutely nothing to a finished piece that I put my name to in 40 minutes. So I put 6.5 minutes of a documentary together in 40 minutes simply by automating the initial string out of that content. It's always easier to modify something that exists than it is to start from scratch. As I said, that was modeled on the way I would do edits. I'd perform an edit, then I would have to explain to my partner what was the rule of thumb that we were using to do it. We did a knowledge system based on my knowledge. Now, I would think that what we're looking at is finding a resource of enough examples of documentary edits with ranking metadata associated with it that we could teach a tool to better perform these templaritized stories lines. Will we ever get a full AI editor? Well, that's a question that's going to be discussed on a panel later in the day. The answer will surprise you. And it's an exciting time for metadata. We all can go crazy a little bit.
That's exactly what it looks like in Warner Brothers, by the way. Philip Hodgins, ladies and gentlemen, thank you for setting that up, Philip. All right, next up, we're going to talk about EITR. And we're going to welcome up the executive director of the Entertainment Identifier Registry, Mr. Don Dolcinos, ladies and gentlemen. Don Dolcinos. You can pace, you can walk around, you can do whatever you want, Don. It's your stage, yes. Did you bring a guitar? I got one.
Borrow your guitar?
Yeah, absolutely.
So hi, everybody. I'm Don Dolcinos, executive director of the Entertainment ID Registry. Which is a industry association, as Guy said, that operates a registry of unique content identifiers. So unique 20-digit string alphanumeric to identify a movie or television program or episode. And also individual IDs that can identify versions of the content, so director's cuts and designs for particular home entertainment markets or broadcast markets, for example, but all nested together in a hierarchy so that if you care about measuring or tracking content at the title level and you want to know about all markets, you can do that. If you want to track it at a detailed, granular level and only know about and compare markets, the architecture allows you to do that. So we operate that registry. We're not really a standards body. We are an industry association, membership driven. I think more than half of you are with companies in this room who are members of EITR. So show of hands if you know about EITR, you're part of it. So this is my favorite conference of the year because it's the majority. Just walking across the room, I've got half of my heaviest users, practitioners, who either create EITR IDs for content or track it for different purposes, and they're in the room. So the load on our servers is really low today. So I could reduce some of the help desk. So I won't talk then very much more about EITR itself, but what I want to talk about is kind of two announcements that have to do with our growth and the application of that registry and the EITR IDs in different kinds of workflows. Where we probably have been the most successful is one that's up here now, is around the digital supply chain. And so I actually stole this slide from Jason Pena, who's with Google. But EITR is, along with sister organizations like EMA and Movie Labs, part of a set of standard ways to communicate metadata about content and have that happen from the content supplier over to the digital distributor, online distributors. So Google is represented here, but it's we also have as members Amazon, Netflix, Microsoft, Vudu. So the kind of the benefits that are coming out here are applied to all those kinds of companies as well as all the content companies. And so this has been going on for some time, where an EiderID is embedded in a new batch of avails and goes over to Google, and there's a communication about which ones they will put up on their portal. And what Eider has done is been a key identifier that both sides use, and so in that back and forth, before that avail actually gets up and running as an asset, all the communication can be better automated. And so when you do that and measure what has happened before and after, just again, Eider, but also in combination with these other standards, has reduced the processing time before that content gets to the market on the order of 20 times, 30 times improvement. So something, a batch of programs that would have taken 50 hours to process and prepare and get up on the portal takes a half an hour. So you multiply that by all the acquisition deals that you do, all the distribution deals that you do, and there's some significant cost savings there. So that's been happening. The announcement today is follows on to that. It's something we've been waiting on for a little bit of time, and it's come to fruition, whereas Google has announced that their YouTube transactional reports, which are the reports back to the suppliers about the performance, now include that EiderID as well. So it's not a one-way path to get that content to the portal, but actually the financial reporting coming back is now including that EiderID. So whereas before that efficiency was certainly benefiting both sides of the equation, now the content supplier, the studios, have a little bit more information now that is keyed to this ID that they already use in their internal title management systems. And now that creates some interesting additional benefits and opportunities. So that transaction report also includes, I talked about the granularity, and both the title ID and a version ID if one was supplied, what we also call the edit ID. And so you can report on that level of granularity as well, or aggregate up to the total roll-up. So pretty exciting for us. We call it the round trip. And so that sets the stage kind of for part two of what you can do with an EiderID now that it's a little bit more available. So we have the growth of Eider's in the registry itself is we just topped 1 million unique records this end of last year, now at 1.1 million unique IDs for content, and a lot, pretty much coverage of domestic markets for both film and television, certainly at the current new releases stage. And a rich database to start drawing from. One of the things we do inside that, if you don't know already, is for every given record for piece of content, there are 50 or so metadata fields that can be or need to be filled in to generate that unique ID. One of those fields is called the alternate ID or alt ID. And so you think of IMDb IDs that link to their pages for that piece of content, or Rotten Tomatoes, or internal studio IDs. There's a large number of them. Interestingly, and it makes sense kind of intuitively, that there are more of those alternate IDs now in our system than the actual records. So obviously, in each individual record have multiple alternate IDs. We're up over 1.5 million of those alternate IDs. So why does that matter? So this is an example of the Mighty Max. Everybody seen the Mighty Max? It's a Catholic girls high school state champion basketball team. Feel good story of the year. So I have no idea, but that's the EiderID under the title there. And what you find in the system is a list of alternate IDs, and some of them are represented here in the graphics, but you can link to the ID for the IMDb page, for the Rotten Tomatoes page. We have, the IVA site, Internet Video Archive, which has trailers and other information about content. So you can get to those third-party sources of rich, much, much richer metadata that's available about that content than we carry. So what ends up as the case is Eider as a cross-reference to those value-add databases. Very seamless, automated way to call up that information. And so we've started to see over the last year or so much more use of that capability among our member companies. And again, it can be the people that create the content, or it can be people who do tracking and reporting. So this is an example of some of the companies. So again, keying off that main same ITER ID, you can go to that third-party database. And the use cases we have here are for Sony Pictures, they actually have used the alternate ID to gather more information from multiple databases leading up to a decision to greenlight a new film. So they look, search for info about related films, related stars. And so having the ITER ID to make that cross-reference makes it a little bit easier to do that. S&P Global, a new member company of ITER just this year, an interesting database of market intelligence. Again, want to key off that ID to bring in their rich set of metadata that they're, of course, you know, sell marketing to the other member companies. Ampere Analysis is a company in the UK that does tracking of pricing and availability on multiple platforms. They do that for several of the studios here. And again, key all that data to an ITER ID that goes back to the studio, who again has that ITER ID as an organizing factor in-house. And the last one's pretty interesting. We had a subsidiary of Nielsen. Nielsen Home Entertainment was a member company, and they tracked home entertainment ratings in particular. They were sold to this company called NPD, which is a much larger consumer intelligence database. And so there's a linkage from the content information and sort of the rich metadata around the piece of content itself and consumer behavior related to related kind of topics, genres, whatever you know about that film. And so you start to see leveraging this system of alternate IDs, which again is not really our core competence to just have that. It was created to help ID the content, but it's sort of an emergent property of what ITER is today. So as an industry association, we kind of are evolving in a couple of interesting different directions. Don't think of ourselves much anymore as a standards organization and much more as a product company. And now we have additional features that we can offer around that product. So I think that's where I'll stop.
Awesome. Thank you, Don. Thanks so much. All right, next up to talk about the work that he's been doing with ETC around the C4 framework architecture, Mr. Joshua Colan.
Thank you. So, I've been working with the Entertainment Technology Center on cloud workflows and metadata related to managing your workflows and so forth in cloud, but I'm not going to talk about any of that because it's far too boring. Instead, what I wanted to talk about was this observation that I've been making over a number of events or just components of the differences between the businesses in Hollywood and the businesses in Silicon Valley. And this kind of speaks to exactly what Amber Case was talking about, which, you know, maybe I'll be able to get around to how it informs C4 and the work that we're doing there. So on the right over here, I took a Lyft, and the routing software, probably Google Maps or something, said, you know, there's going to be an 8-minute delay, there's an accident on the 10, you're on the fastest route. Now, that's an interesting thing to say. You would say, like, well, is it ever, like, not the fastest route? Like, what mapping app is that? You know, like, yeah, we're not going to put you on the fastest route. And if you think about it, it turns out that they're actually, it isn't even possible. If you were to take your car and literally turn it around and go point it in the opposite direction, it would route you by turning you around, going around the block, and that would be the fastest route from going the wrong direction. You're always going to be on the fastest route. So in fact, the statement you're on the fastest route doesn't even mean anything. It doesn't impart any information to you at all. It's just to make you feel more comfortable, to make you confident that it's doing something that it should be doing. So in fact, it does the opposite if you are too aware of it, which is that it hides the fact that it has no idea whether you're on the fastest route or not. It knows how to route you through the roads, but you might have made a horrible decision a moment ago, and it's not going to tell you that that was a mistake. It'll tell you now that you've made the mistake, this is the fastest route. Another observation is similar along these same lines is if you take a look at Netflix. So a few years ago, Netflix famously did a contest to figure out how to optimize their recommendation system. And they came up with a very, very good one. But isn't it odd that you can't just sort everything by the ones you like? Like, if you actually go to Netflix, you would think, well, you know typically. I mean, that's pretty accurate for me. You pretty much know what I would also rate 5 stars or whatever. Why don't you give me the playlist of, you know, 5, 4.999, 4.998, you know, why don't you give me, like, the best recommendations possible? And I can skip through them if I don't think you're right. But they don't. So that's an interesting question. And the third observation is, what made Amazon a successful company? Is it because they were the largest bookseller? Actually, no. The reason that they were a successful company is because they were the best logistics company. All of these different things, from these companies to these technologies to these user interfaces, all have some hidden component behind them that makes them, that's intentional. You know, it is intentional that you can't sort by stars on Netflix. In fact, they used to have an API where other third-party services could do it, and they took that API away. So the idea from all of this, as I, you know, kind of, I started in production, and I took this, you know, dramatic left turn a few years ago, realizing that production services wasn't such a great business to be in after all, and started looking at how these technologies work and why they are approached in this way, which is a lot different than the way that we work in media production, at least as far as my experience goes. And what you end up discovering is that there's, you know, it's, you know, like with if you have, for Netflix, for example, if you have, you know, say 10 things that you know somebody will like and 90 things that's just noise, they'll unsubscribe in a second if they see too many of those. The problem is if you show them all 10 up front, then they're done and they can unsubscribe, right? So you want to create this kind of gambler's phenomenon where, oh, I might get a good one, I might not get a bad one, I'll hang around and see if I can't discover another one. And so they have to leave, even though they know which one would be the next best one to recommend, they have to kind of disable that functionality almost a little adversarially for the user. So once you are aware of how these kind of things have this hidden kind of structure to them, you can actually intentionally design things using that information, right? So one of the philosophies that has really driven what C4, our cloud, open source cloud framework, is all about is discoverability, which is a lot like what Amber Case is talking about in terms of calm technology. It's this idea that you can yell at people all you want on set to change their behavior, but they won't change their behavior. So is it possible, using the best things that we can figure out, is it possible for us to use what they do in a way that can be discovered or reassembled meaningfully in the future? So we kind of announced last year this idea that's kind of one of the pivot points of C4 is this idea of indelible metadata, where there's a way with C4 to create a relationship between, with no structure on top of it, no database, no UI, nobody telling people how to enter data or anything like that, just the data existing in the same place at the same time, or other kinds of information that's discoverable information, you can link these things together. Because what you end up being able to do with C4 is you can ID things in a way that can't be extracted from the thing that was ID'd. So, for example, if I have a file on set, a script supervisor took some notes and some, you know, raw files went onto some hard drives, they went in separate directions, and at some point later in time at a different facility that knew nothing about what the process was, maybe those files happened to end up, you know, in on some hard drive somewhere. C4 gives us the ability to have an ID of those items, and anyone who's ever handled them can find the ID of it without connecting to the internet, without any external services or software. And it's the same ID regardless. So if you're in archive and you're just starting to do it there, you can do an ID. It's the same ID that you would have had you looked at it on set. So what this means is we can say, well, this this file and this other file had this both had these IDs on this hard drive at this point in time. Or this software makes a note of the ID in some metadata or some other location somewhere else. Or somebody just manually writes that information in, like copies the ID into a note somewhere. Now, it's possible with this kind of a system to have a completely self-restoring structure where you could just search, do a text search through files on a hard drive, find IDs, and find where that ID is mentioned elsewhere, and you can reconstruct the relationships. And when you have that ability to structure these relationships, then you can attach meaning, because you can say, well, here's some data that could be from a camera report or it could be from something else, but I can locate its ID in a visual effects note, I can locate its ID on a hard drive log that got delivered to a certain location, and you're able to take and web this information back together again and say what was related to what. Who knew about what file when? And now you can actually say, okay, well, this file then, regardless of what it actually says in the file, I know is related to that movie or that window of time or whatever. So this creates this passive background structure that can kind of keep people from having to build things manually on their own and be able to come back later and still discover what the structure was, even if they didn't even plan for what that structure would be. So C4 Framework is an open source framework, moving through standards now, and it's all designed around this idea of this same kind of concept, calming technology, where it just allows people to work the way they normally work, and it captures as much information from that system as it can. So, that's it.
Josh Golden, thank you. Fantastic. Next up, we have Eric Hansen. He's the Digital Media Industry Evangelist for the Entertainment Merchants Association, EMA. Give a warm welcome to Eric.
Thanks, everybody. It's great to be here. I'm going to be talking about how we're leveraging metadata in the digital supply chain for on-demand video. So prepare to be amazed and wowed. Let's see. There's a button here. There we go. So I'm going to start by talking about our vision. For the digital supply chain with EMA. Imagine a world where the digital supply chain actually enables innovation in consumer experiences, in business and in content availability. That's really what we're driving for in all of the EMA and the DEG and the folks that are working in the digital supply chain space. Sadly, what we find in practice is that the digital supply chain actually kind of gets in the way of innovation. It's a little bit clunky, I guess might be one word for it. Highly manual, there's a lot of exception processing that goes on and lots of people. We're spending hundreds of millions of dollars as an industry on this, and there's a lot of people that will never get hours of their lives back that are searching through file shares looking for or Excel spreadsheets, looking for caption files, looking for video assets and things like that. So it's our vision to free those people up and to really enable the supply chain actually to support our industry. So I'm going to talk about, first of all, automation, because to make this vision a reality, we are going to require automation. And so I've got a couple of examples of some automations that I thought were kind of interesting. So Garrett, if you want to go ahead and play this video. This happens to be a packaging plant for IKEA. And you can see they've got these awesome blue robots that are not shaped like people. And they're doing their jobs. They have one very simple job each to do, and they're kind of doing it over and over and over. It's very consistent, very reliable. The outputs that each one of them is producing is always the same. The inputs are always the same. They're very consistent, very standard. The environment that they're in is also very consistent. It's not changing. There's no tornadoes running through there or floods or anything like that, and people aren't bumping things around. It's very, very consistent. So you can go to the back to the slides, Garrett. So what's allowing this to work in an efficient, reliable, and scalable way is kind of those standards, the standard desired output. It's one thing that machine is supposed to do. It's standard inputs and a consistent environment and reliable machines. Those robots are good at what they do, that one simple thing. Okay, so I want to look at another example of an automation. This one a little less ideal. I don't know how many of you may be familiar with the game Mousetrap. It was popular when I was a kid. The way it's supposed to work is that you want to go ahead and cue the video? Thanks. The way it's supposed to work is you turn this little crank, and then the boot hits the thing, and then the bucket turns over, and a ball rolls down the stairs, and it runs. Anyway, this is kind of what happens when you're playing the game. And, okay, manual effort. Oh, man. Okay, back up there. There we go. It's going good. Come on, ball. Oh, the ball's rolling around on the table. Another exception, manual effort, right? So, sadly, you know, what's happening here is sort of similar to what's going on in our digital supply chain. You might be surprised to learn. It's very inefficient, unreliable, and it's definitely not scalable. And some of the reasons for this is because it's not a standard output. So you look at the Mousetrap game, that little mouse, he might or she might not be in the exact right space when you drop the little cage on him, and so you miss him. So you need, you know, the output is changing over time. The inputs are changing, like, depending on how hard you crank the force that you put on that crank, it changes the whole thing, and it may or may not work. The pieces are kind of cheap, and they don't really fit in the right spaces all the time, so it's not very a reliable system. And the environment's also not very consistent. Somebody could bump the table or spill a beverage on it or something, and then it doesn't work. So this is a good example of how automation doesn't work when it doesn't have what it needs to function. So what does this tell us about our digital supply chain? For online video. So we have a lot of the same problems. We're dealing with a lot of specialness in our supply chains. We have a lot of special snowflakes. We have specialness in the output. We're making videos with audio and subtitles and captions. That sounds kind of consistent, except there's 8 different languages, and you can combine them in like a lot of different ways. And so when I'm publishing in Germany, I want German subtitles and French subtitles, and dubs in English and Spanish. And then when I publish in Japan, it's a completely different thing. And then we have captions. So that the output has a lot of variability. The input also, we have some standards for this, which is really helping us, but a lot of it is still got a long ways to go before it comes really to be a standard. We have spreadsheets that are really prone to error. And so the inputs also have a lot of variability in them. The environment, I like to think of this as what we're kind of allowed to do with the videos, kind of our rights. And that gets expressed in avails. Also, constantly changing. This video is, we can make this episode live on this date, and then it has to come off the service, and then the price changes, and then on this date and in this territory you can go up. There's a lot of variability there as well. So what do we do about this? How do we manage all of this variability? Metadata, of course, and I think this might be Phil's alter ego, Captain Metadata. Metadata provides the data about the inputs, the outputs, and the environments that our systems need to be scalable, efficient, reliable, and repeatable. That's how we tell our smart systems, which actually are reliable, they're computers and servers and they're programmed by people, and we can get them to do the same thing over and over. That part we've got, I think, figured out for the most part. That's what computers are great at. It's the world around them that is constantly changing, and we don't have good information about. So that's what EMA and the DEG and many of the folks in the digital supply chain are working on. And so we've made great progress. We have the environment space. So we have an avail spec, and it's been adopted by a large portion of the content industry. We're getting avails now for our retailers in close to 100% of the studios are sending us EMA spec avails. And that's just for movies. We've got a long ways to go for television. They're in spreadsheets, so they're still not completely automated, but we actually have a consistent language that we're talking. In the input side, these are the assets that we're using to assemble to make videos available. The video files, the artwork files, the caption, the subtitles, the dub files, or the audio files. We have a spec for this as well. It's called the Media Manifest Core, MMC. It's not as widely adopted as the avail spec is, something that we're working on hard this year to drive adoption for this so that we can tell our computers what they're getting instead of having people figure that out. On the output side, we don't actually have a specification for retailers to order the assets that go with their output. That's something that we'll be working on this year, an asset order specification. So there we are, metadata describing the outputs, inputs, and the environment to our system. So it's really the superpower of our process and of our operations is the metadata. So I know you guys are all super excited about this, and you can't wait to find out how you can help. We'd love to have you join one of our working groups. We have projects going on in this space. We'd love to hear from you, talk to me, talk to some of the other EMA people. Dave Lindsay from Disney is also representing DEG. Get involved. You can initiate DSC, digital supply chain projects, in your organizations, your companies. This is not going to happen. It's not going to get solved in verticals, in individual organizations, individual companies. This is a problem that is pervasive across our industry. As I said, we're spending hundreds of millions of dollars on it and wasting lives. Those are important. Let's get those people into more interesting jobs than hunting through spreadsheets. And you can evangelize the industry specifications and the standards in your own organizations as well. And that's all I got. Thank you.
Awesome. Thank you, Eric. Speaking of the Digital Entertainment Group, Dave Lindsay is here representing the Technology and Operations Committee. But he also has a day job. He's the Director of Operations Strategy at the Walt Disney Company. Give a warm welcome to Dave.
Thank you. I see some Disney people here. Can you put your hands up? I just want to, all right.
Hey.
Good showing, good. thank you for the intro, guy. Yes, I'm Dave Lindsay with the Walt Disney Company, and I am here speaking on behalf of the DEG. Here is a slide with lots of pretty logos on it from people that are members of the DEG, and here is a couple of other members of the committee that I'm here representing, the Technology and Operations Committee. So a lot of content providers up there and our friends at Movie Labs. So what is the Technology and Operations Committee? We're basically a group of members consisting of those content providers that you saw there earlier. We get together in a room every 5 weeks or so, and we lock the door, and we try to come up with some solutions, or at least work towards those solutions that is affecting kind of our daily lives. And sometimes we get to go outside. Today is one of those days, and we get to talk to you fine folks about some of the stuff that's going on in our world. And that's what I'm here to do today. So I'm here on behalf of that organization. Thank you again to Mesa for letting us speak here. Earlier in the year, we kind of got together again in one of those locked door sessions, and we surveyed our membership and said, what do we want to focus on for this year? What can we really make some meaningful progress in? So we came up with a big list of initiatives. Everyone kind of came back and said, we feel this, this, and this is important. So I'm just going to go through that list with you here. And number one on our list of important items, big surprise, drum roll, avails. Didn't see that one coming at all. We've been working on this one for a long time, 2-3+ years or so, but we're really, 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 really close. I feel like this is the year for avails, right? And if someone's up here saying that again next year, then it probably won't be me. We think we're really close. So as Eric was saying, there's more understanding of avails. There's more adoption of this. Does everyone in this room know what avails are, by the way? It's basically content availability notices that we need to send out to our partners in the, kind of fulfillment space to say when content can go live, not go live, how much it needs to cost and everything. So we have, this method of sending this out. It's not standardized at all. Some people send out PDFs for people to then rekey and transpose. This is basically a specification that we're all saying, yes, we are going to adopt this, we're going to implement this, and we're going to make this happen to alleviate all these pain points. We've made a lot of progress in terms of feature avails adoption, and now we want to increase that adoption with other partners, as well as work on TV avails adoption, and also kind of move from Excel to XML. So that's what we're doing with avails this year primarily. Another old friend of ours, Eider. Thank you, Don. We also want to really kind of continue with the momentum that we've had in 2015, 2016 on EIDR proliferation, EIDR adoption, EIDR usage. again, a lot of it's just kind of been, you know, getting familiar with these terms and these concepts and applying this within our business. And that's why these things have taken so long. It's, you know, kind of hard to steer a big, you know, container ship or cruise ship. And so we're kind of getting to this point where we're, you know, we're rolling out EITR within our business itself, as well as, you know, using it in these kind of external communications. And so for EITR this year, we're going to be, you know, continuing to apply that to our content, respective content libraries. And then also looking at how it can apply to bonus content and compilations. And again, you know, also really advocating that it's, you know, using round trip reporting. Another initiative that we're interested in is ratings. So here in the U.S., it's not really a big deal. It's got an MPAA rating. But outside the U.S., as you get into many other territories, many smaller territories, it gets really complex and sticky and gray. And it's just know it's complicated. I won't go into all the nuances, but in terms of, you know, the way in which certain partners interpret ratings or require ratings versus don't require ratings versus, you know, utilize different ratings organizations for different countries, there's just a whole mess there that we're going to try to work through with our friends in EMA and with other partners that are involved in that space. This is a kind of a new initiative maybe to many people in the room. We're calling it platform profiles. This is a way to kind of describe through sort of attributes and annotations. So can I come up with a controlled vocabulary or taxonomy of what constitutes, you know, a supply chain partner's capabilities? So an example for this is, you know, for those of you who still go into a Target or a Best Buy and buy, you know, something off the shelf there, you know, like a DVD or a Blu-ray, that's a very consistent experience. You know, it doesn't matter where you go, you get the same product. But if you were to buy a digital, you know, version of that product on, say, Amazon versus Vudu versus, you know, Google versus iTunes, you would get slightly nuanced versions of that same product. You get the same base feature, but some of the attributes of that will kind of vary from partner to partner. So for instance, the bonus content on Amazon, they tack it to the very end of the movie. So you have to fast forward through the whole movie to see the, you know, the deleted scenes and the bonus content. iTunes, you have a very menu-driven experience. Vudu, you may be experiencing that bonus content through cross-platform extras. And then Google, you may not actually have a bonus experience based on the limitations of their platform. So we want to basically collect all of these attributes that describe what a partner's capabilities are, and then kind of, you know, put that together into a database. And then, you know, use that both to inform our partners in, you know, planning, product planning and marketing based on, you know, what campaigns can I run, what are the capabilities, what does it look like on a storefront for this title, and then into actual fulfillment operations. So, you know, we want to get to this world where we have, you know, a tool that's basically, you know, taking our product from vision to actual execution to live on storefront, lots of decisions to be made along the way. And so this is one of those inputs into those, you know, decisions so that we can kind of get to that that world of automation for delivery. The fifth initiative that we've identified is MES files, IMF, and heck, let's throw Common Manifest in there too. So anything related to, you know, kind of the file-based delivery, want to roll up our sleeves and really kind of investigate that a bit more. IMF has been a great kind of like R&D concept, and we really want to see where does this fit within the world of distribution. Since this is a metadata kind of related luncheon, let's put a little metadata label on this stuff. I don't know if these are approved terms, descriptive, business, technical, and temporal, but I kind of like to use them. So, you know, to kind of bucket our initiatives into those kinds of you know, terms. Business metadata over there with Avails Ratings platform profile, technical metadata, stuff that, you know, is related to the assets and essences. So this is, in a sense, metadata about the metadata. Is that allowed? I don't know. So we have all these kind of initiatives and standards that are all kind of moving in this, you know, general direction of positiveness. But what we're, you know, seeing is there's kind of like discrete implementations, both within content providers, within platforms, within our, you know, our friends in like the service providers, the post-production houses, and they're, you know, automating stuff out. But how do we really kind of connect those partners in this ecosystem? Because we kind of have like manual steps in between. We have this, the mouse trap where you got to, you know, pick up the ball and chuck it forward a little bit more. So how do we get there? And this is another initiative that I'm really super excited about, and want to also, you know, let everyone know about in this room here today. And it's really this notion of connecting all the dots through an API. It's not a new notion by any means. It's been talked about for, you know, several years, but we're, I think we're now at this point where we're familiar with the concepts, the standards are out there, people are informed enough, and we've, you know, all been facing, you know, death by a thousand cuts for long enough. So I think we're ready to take this initiative. Some immediate use cases with Avails data exchange. You know, as we're targeting Avails, we want to move to XML-based data exchange of that. But this is really going to, you know, expand out quickly to a lot of other use cases. The orders API, orders use cases, asset delivery, actually pushing assets up to our partners, checking for status, ingestion status, QC status, availability, storefront status, and then sales data reporting back into us. This is an initiative that is an industry initiative. We need a lot of involvement from everyone in this room here, through trade associations, through whatever, you know, it is that you can bring to the table to make this a reality, because it's really only going to work if it has a lot of involvement. We want people to, you know, embrace this. And like I said, we're going to be starting with Avails right now, just because that is kind of where we have a lot of momentum. So, is anyone interested in, you know, any of these initiatives? Cool, yeah, great, we got some. Where you can go for more.
Sorry, that was the plant. That
was check out our website. You can email Alex. She coordinates a lot of member activities. We're having some joint working groups with our friends at in EMA to really partner on these initiatives. Because like I said, it really takes everyone to kind of make this come together. So thank you.
Awesome. Dave, it takes a village. DEG. Digital Entertainment Group, thanks so much. Okay, last but certainly not least, he is the Director of Archives and Asset Management at HBO, and he's representing the Association of Moving Image Archivists, an important piece of this chain, Mr. Randall Luckow.
Hi. So Amiya asked me to come and speak about Amiya and some of the work that I'm doing with a committee that I'm chairing, the Cataloging Metadata Committee. I've been a long-term member of AMIA, and I'm a big fan of being a member of professional organizations. And I'm discovering now, as I'm interviewing a lot of millennials, that they're not seeing the same kind of value in long-term relationships with long-standing professional organizations. So I'm here to kind of pitch AMIA and what AMIA is about and the value in joining AMIA. So the association itself, the Association of Moving Image Archivists, was established in 1990, but it actually has a longer history than that. It actually goes back to an antecedent, which is the Film and Television Archives Advisory Committee that began back in 65, 67 to advise the NEA and some other pseudo-government groups on film and television archiving. Today, the AMIA organization itself has a membership that's still primarily individuals working in film and television assets or within the industry, or academics with studies in related fields. Like I said, I've been a member of AMIA since 1997, so I've been much like 20 years now. How do I do this? Just press that. Oh, there we go. Yeah, that's great. Okay. So AMIA itself is an international nonprofit organization dedicated to the preservation and use of time-based media. We have a very diverse membership of individuals worldwide with a cross-section of media expertise. You do archivists, technicians, students, engineers, and just plain old film enthusiasts. While not everybody who is a member considers himself an archivist or a paraprofessional, in some ways all of our members interact with time-based media at some point in its life cycle. I realize I'm just before the post-lunch nap. Okay. So AMIA was founded on a commitment to provide a space for the members to collaborate in person. This is exemplified by the annual conference and other events that AMIA hosts throughout the year. The association itself is governed by a board of directors and a president, all elected on two-year cycles by and from the membership. I've been a member, like I said, for 20 years, so I've been on the board, I've been committee chairs, I've been participating on committees, and in some cases I've just been somebody sitting in the back room doing nothing, and that's even the best ever, not actually doing anything for a while. The membership itself forms committees, in order to collaborate in projects they find of interest. And these committees and collaborations can take the form of workshops, event sessions, and publications as simple as fact sheets, guidelines, best practices, or something more formal like books and publications. Some examples of committees are the Copyright Committee, the Education Committee, the Open Source Committee, Preservation Committee, and of course the most important committee of all, the Cataloging and Metadata Committee. Okay. So this committee is primarily focused on cataloging and metadata, and is a forum to share knowledge through partnership with standards bodies. Our committee members are not exclusive to EMEA, but are also members of other organizations such as ALA, SAA, FIAT, FIAF, and SMPTE. As a number of people like Mesa, I think we said, it's not a standards body. EMEA is not a standards body. The committee members, however, have different needs, and we try to address questions about implementing standards, which range from basic to advanced. In our workshops, we discover things and discuss things like premise, mods, METs, and what are the differences and how do you actually implement them in your institutions? Okay. Our committee members come from a broad range of institutions where they've implemented a gamut of metadata standards and in-house best practices. So for the past 20 years or so, the Cataloging and Metadata Committee has offered hands-on workshops with curriculum that provides implementation strategies based on the resources and needs of those attending. We cover topics ranging from data model and the conceptual and data authorities to linked data and to the actual practical, how you do asset management, how you implement it, and how do you provide content description for accessibility. We're also currently developing some online educational opportunities and coursework. In 2001, the Cataloging and Metadata Committee published a Compendium of Cataloging Practice, and since then we've seen a lot of technological change in the field. So we're working on a revision, and the compendium update started as a way to reflect the impact of digital on cataloging and metadata practices, but as the surveys went out, we opened up the scope to more international organizations, and we tried to find institutions to spread out the knowledge a little bit more from the domestic English-based organizations that were part of the initial 2001 survey and publication. So we reached out to IASA for Sound Archives members, FIAT, FIAF, for broadcasters, and for film archives. As I said, the 2001 survey was primarily in the U.S., so along with other English-speaking countries like the U.K., Australia, and Canada. But the 2017 revision ensures that the new compendium will reflect worldwide practices. Okay. So in 2001, the number of responding archives was 27. In 2017, in this revision, we have nearly 100 institutions participating worldwide. And currently, the status of the compendium is that we're editing the findings section and working on final revisions with the institutions that have provided case studies. So, interestingly, what we discovered, the difference between 2001 and 2017, is that we actually have seen now a greater variety of practices and increasingly diverse implementations. So the team working on the revision, we discussed ways of including some way to contextualize all of these new changes and how the fractioning or fractaling, maybe, is that a word, of the way of these practices out in a way that we could actually contextualize them with a series of case studies so that when you read the results, you can actually see why they made the choices they made in those particular institutions. So we're going to be including the case studies as well as the survey results and some sample catalog records. The case studies were chosen to show a diversity of approaches. We're not going to have case studies for every institution who's participated. But the online materials, which will be new in this revision, will enhance the findings, and we're going to be sharing the raw data as well if anybody is interested in it. So with the addition of the case studies and findings, it kind of pushed out the publication a little bit further than we wanted it to be. And I wanted to be able to come and say, you know, what the publication date is going to be, but I'm not meeting with the publisher until next week. It turned out that way. I was kind of hoping I could say what, you know, it's going to be by the end of the year, but the assumption is that it will be in 2017. Okay. So this is my kind of pitch for EMEA, that we have a number of events throughout the year, a number of flagship events. The upcoming event is the Digital Asset Symposium on May 5th in New York City, and that focuses primarily on case studies discussing current challenges and breakthroughs in managing digital assets today. The Real Thing, which is the Real Thing Technical Symposium, is going to be held in Amsterdam in May. And again, it'll be repeated in the same, usually the same program will be repeated in Los Angeles in August, and we don't have quite a date for that yet. But that brings together technologists and specialists discussing the latest in preservation and restoration technologies. And then, of course, our annual conference in November, it's going to be sandwiched between Thanksgiving and Christmas this year, which is such a great time for everybody to go to a conference. But it worked out well because it's going to be in New Orleans, which really, is there any a better time to go to New Orleans than at Christmas time? So what we will see, though, is on average about 700 media professionals from all over the world. So I actually have a kind of a, I'm running out of time. I thought I was going to go a little faster than this. I did bring a copy of the 2001 compendium if no one has ever seen it and you're interested in seeing what that looks like. I've also got some copies of the Journal of the Association, which is called The Moving Image, if you've not seen those. Thank you.
Brandon Lukow.